Okay, so I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity to speak. I'll speak about applications of non-equilibrium models in biological systems, and just to make you relax a bit, I'll only talk about one kind of biological system. I'll talk only about molecular motors. So the general plan for the 3 hours is first start with an overview of molecular motors. I'll try and argue why do people study them at all? Why are they interesting? Both from a biological point of view and physical point of view. I'll go over the physical conditions, the details that are typically skipped over, but are important to know if you're actually going to model these systems. So I'll actually go into all the scales, etc., which are ignored in physics talks. And then I'll tell you how people study them experimentally. I'll go over experimental techniques, and specifically I'll talk about single molecule experiments, which have more or less revolutionized this field in the last 10 years. The next thing I'll discuss is theoretical models of single motors, and I'll discuss different approaches. There's been some debate and some confusion about different types of modeling of these systems, and I'll try and give you my own understanding of this debate and how the different models are done. Then I'll go on and discuss some work that I was involved in on the effects of disorder and how these motors walk. And then hopefully in the last talk I'll get to discussing many interacting models, and I'll discuss interactions between them. And one question which I'll try and convey is, can you get help at all from driven diffusive systems? Are they important for understanding these systems? Can people who study these systems just ignore the knowledge that has been gained from non-equilibrium? So a question to keep in mind, and you could argue with me over dinner or whatever, is it helpful at all to use non-equilibrium models to understand such systems? Could an experimentalist interested in understanding these systems go on living without the help from a non-equilibrium stat mech? And I'll try and convince you that in some cases, if you want to understand experiments correctly, then you actually have to know something about non-equilibrium driven systems. But I'm happy to argue about this point as much as you want. So some of the work I'll discuss was done with other people, and I've written down all the people that were involved in the works, but many of the work was not mine, and I'll mention the name specifically then. I've highlighted in bold people in which much of the collaboration has been done, and these are David Nelson, David Lubensky, Mara Prentice, who's an experimentalist doing single molecule biophysical experiments, and among other things, Jean-François Joanny and Otgar Campas. And this work with them is, as you can guess, related to the talk Patricia gave at the beginning of the week. So why did I study them? And I'll start from the biological point of view. And this goes down to something called the central dogma of biology, which is kind of a very loose picture of how things work in the cell, each and every one of your cells in the body. And the idea is that you have DNA. I have the analogy. Okay. DNA, which is loosely for this crowd like a hard disk. It contains all the information that you have to know in order to function. So all the information is stored on the hard disk. And then there's a process which is called transcription, in which you copy bits of the DNA onto RNA molecules, which are very similar to DNA. I won't get into the detail. Specifically, messenger RNA molecules, which are just copies of a single gene, if you want. So that's analogous of taking some file from your hard disk and putting it in the RAM. Now you're going to use it, so you want to have it readily accessible. The next step is translation, in which you take the information that's stored in RNA, and again, I'm skipping a lot of details which are very important in the biological context many times, and you translate the information from the RNA into a protein. Okay, so you take the information, and the rough analogy is that you take the information in the RAM and you provide some picture. And the picture creates some response in the human being or in something else, and that, again, feeds a loop. So the idea is that DNA will produce an RNA, will produce a protein. Proteins will do many things in the cell. They're the working horses of the cell. Among other things, they'll decide which other information will be read from the DNA, and you'll have this feedback mechanism. Another important ingredient of the cell dogma is replication. The DNA is basically copied. You have one copy of DNA, the cell divides, and then you have two copies of DNA. So that's basically like copying a hard disk and having another laptop or whatever available. So the central dogma is a nice picture to have in mind when you think about how a cell works. And of course, much of the interest stems from examples where the central dogma is violated, etc. And again, I won't get into these details. So the central dogma is DNA replicates, there's transcription into RNA, and then translation into protein. And something has to make this work. And the thing that makes it work are molecular motors. Every step of this process and many other steps in the body are caused by molecular motors. And here I just listed a small number of molecular motors. Here you have helicase, which runs along DNA and separates the two strands around the replication of DNA. It's a much more complicated process. It actually involves of the order of 9 motors and enzymes doing the process really. And the transcription, there's a motor that I'll discuss quite a bit in this talk. It's called RNA polymerase. And it literally runs along DNA and makes a copy of the information of the DNA and pulls out an RNA molecule from the side. So there's actually a motor which is doing this process. Finally, in the process of making RNA into protein, there's yet another motor. And that's ribosome. And here you see, I really like this picture. It's many ribosomes running along messenger RNA. So again, they're running along this molecule. And you can see that they're making protein. And you can notice that they're walking in this direction because the protein is getting longer as you walk in this direction. So if you want to really understand the details of how things work, you have to study in detail these machines. Again, there's also practical reasons for studying these machines. Sometimes if one of these machines doesn't work, then you have some disease, etc. So you could spend easily 9 hours discussing molecular motors, and I've just listed a few examples. There's literally many, many kinds. So the rough definition of molecular motor, which I'll use in this talk, is complexes of protein which use chemical energy to perform mechanical work. So the canonical example, which has been discussed here, and you saw movies of this and what have you, is kinesin, because it's been studied experimentally a lot. There's a lot of data available on this motor. And I'll come and discuss it more, but it's basically like a bus in the cell. It takes a vesicle, which is typical a lipid membrane, which contains some protein, and transfers it from one side of the cell to the other. You see that it also makes tubes and other interesting things. But at least for the starting part of the talk, it's like a bus. It carries some matter from one side of the cell. It walks along a track, and I'll come to the track later, which is a microtubule. So one function of molecular motors is buses in the cell. Another function which I've discussed is replication of RNA. And I've told you about the helicase, which is involved in this. This is the helicase in this case. And just to give you an impression of how complicated the thing is in actual life, you can see that you have all these different motors running along making the thing happen. And just to impress you even more, not by something I did, but people have been able to actually to throw DNA in a solution with a different components and get DNA to replicate in vitro. And they produce RNA, and when you do biological things, you have the advantage that you can have movies. Okay, so this is a movie that was made by Australian TV of the actual process of making messenger RNA, and the idea was to take biologists, talk with them, and ask how will this thing look if you blow it up and have the ability to look at this thing. If you notice carefully, it's even making noises. But you can see here, this is a site that's called a promoter, and it marks where the messenger, where the RNA polymerase has to bind to start the reading of the information. There's other helper prefactors, and then there's an initiation factor which releases the RNA polymerase. You can't hear the noise. And it's running along the DNA, okay, and copying the information on the DNA and producing the messenger RNA. Okay, so it's basically picking up from the solution. I'll come back to this later in the talk. It's picking up from the solution the part that it needs to build the messenger RNA, and it's running along the DNA. Can you hear it making a noise? Okay. It's picking up the needed part, and it's making the messenger RNA. You can see that in the minds of the people who made it, and I think that this is an important point. It's moving very deterministically. It's like a train. It's running along the track, making the messenger RNA, and eventually it releases the messenger RNA, and this molecule, by some magic, knows exactly where it's going. And when it gets to that place, it's being translated. Hopefully this will be quicker. By a ribosome. Okay, so it's getting out of this is the nucleus of the cell. It's, by magic, it knows how to get out very smoothly. And then ribosome clings on. There's two parts to the ribosome. Okay? And it clings on to the messenger RNA, and these are called transfer RNAs. There are molecules which have one part which is RNA, so it's reading the code from the RNA, and one part which is amino acids. There are 20 amino acids from which the different proteins in your body are being made. So it's running along, getting a transfer. It's getting the correct transfer RNA and building the different pieces of the protein. Okay, so again, you can notice that the picture people have in mind is a very deterministic, very nice picture. There's no mistakes. It just keeps on moving without any problems. And one of the questions I'll ask, is this at all realistic? Is it really a deterministic machine or not? Okay, so do you want to keep on watching this? You seem happy, so. So I think I'll stop here. If you want to see it, come to me after the talk. Okay. So they produce RNA, produce proteins. These are their central components to the central dogma. They do many other things, and I just listed one problem which has interested some physicists. They move cells. This is an E. coli bacteria, and their motors, which actually rotate, which are rotary motors, and what they do is rotate these flagella. They're kind of long, not sure about the word in English. Somebody knows the word. Anyway, they rotate and they propel the bacteria in a certain direction, and it's kind of an interesting motion. If they rotate in one direction, these flagella bundle and push the bacteria more or less in a specific direction. If they rotate in the other way, they rotate in random direction, and the bacteria changes its direction randomly. And again, I could spend easily 9 hours discussing other motors, but I won't do that. Okay. So what do you need to do? What do the motors need to do to have to function? And I'll go through the basic ingredients for modeling, and I'll go through them very quickly, because typically these are just glanced over and people don't discuss this, and then when people really model things, they're missing important things. So the first thing that you need is fuel. And the fuel in the case of a cell, in most of these motors, is supplied by a chemical potential gradient. And these vary. There's tons of motors which I've discussed, and you can show different examples. But for the systems that we'll discuss typically in this talk, for example, kinesin or RNA polymerase, the typical scenario is that there's molecules of fuel sitting inside the solution, in this case ATP molecules, okay? And the ATP molecules are form a chemical gradient, and I'll write this explicitly in a second. In principle, this ATP molecule, I'll get back to this picture in a second, okay? This ATP molecule is in chemical equilibrium with products of a reaction which makes it into ADP and one phosphate. So ADP breaks apart and into two pieces, ADP and phosphate. And in principle, there's some chemical equilibrium. If you let the system relax forever, it will reach some chemical equilibrium in which the ratio between, and a simple mean field description, the ratio between the concentration of ATP and the ratio between the concentration of ADP and phosphate is some constant number. Now in the cell, this ratio is not held at the equilibrium value. There's a much higher concentration of ATP. And that causes a chemical energy gradient. Okay? And this chemical energy gradient is the thing that is actually making this motor move along the track. So without the chemical energy, you could think of an experiment done, for example, in vitro, in which you keep the concentration of ATP and ADP and phosphate at its equilibrium value, and then you don't expect the motor to move. Okay, you have to keep the concentration artificially high at a high value to make this thing move. So if you want, this is telling you, of course, if this would happen spontaneously very easy, then it will reach equilibrium very quickly. So this reaction doesn't take place very easily. There's a barrier for this reaction. And what the motor is actually doing is helping this reaction occur. And by helping this reaction occur, by being an enzyme for this reaction, it's using the energy in the process and making itself move. Okay? And you can ask, what's the scale of energy? And in a typical experiment, you could be off by 5 kT. I've set here the Boltzmann constant to be 1. But roughly 1 ATP gives 20 kBT. And there's other sources of fuel in the cell. There's you've probably heard these names. There's GTP, UTP, CTP. You actually notice that they're related to the different bases that you have in the DNA, AT, GC. There's no TTP, but because there's UTP in RNA, but I won't get into this. Now, there's some difference in the energy that each of these molecules supplies, but it's not a huge difference. It's of the order of 1 kBT to 2 kBT. So different fuels have different energies. Okay, so we have fuel. Good, we've got through one thing. And the next thing is a track. And again, these vary. We have microtubules for kinesin, and microtubules are polar filaments. Patricia discussed them a bit. They self-assemble from dimers, and therefore have a specific directionality to them. And kinesin, for example, walks along the microtubules. Microtubules, again, are tracks, which basically take you from one end of the cell to the other, loosely. RNA polymerase has a track, which is DNA. DNA, and it's running along the DNA, and it's running along a specific strand of the DNA. And that's important because a specific strand of the DNA also has directionality to it. So all the tracks that we have are directional, and we have other tracks. But the thing that comes about when you look at these examples is that they're more or less one-dimensional tracks. Here it's really a one-dimensional track. Here you might think that the kinesin moves to a neighboring track or a third neighboring track, but it's almost a one-dimensional track. Okay, and there's no strong evidence that it actually moves from one filament to the other along the microtubule. Okay, the next thing I'll discuss is scales. How big are these things? So we'll start with a bacteria. A bacteria is about 1 micron. So the cells in your body, just to compare, are 12 micron. And kinesin is about 70 to 80 nanometers. People sometimes torment it. It has a tail, and they'll cut off his tail, do strange things to it. But it's on the scale of tens of nanometer. And this has implication. It implies that the Reynolds number, which loosely speaking is the ratio between the importance of inertial forces and viscous forces, okay, so this is the typical expression for Reynolds number, is very low. For kinesin, it's of the order of 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 8. And this means that inertial forces play no role in the motion of these things. It's highly damped motion. You can only move if there's a force acting. If you want, it's more like Brownian motion. And typically say, people say when they describe motors, it's like swimming in honey or swimming in peanut butter. But if you put in the numbers, it's very far from peanut butter and honey. You find that the closest thing to what they're experiencing is us swimming in something that's called pitch that was used about 100 years ago to seal boats. And this is an experiment which started in 1927, in which somebody let this pitch drop. And this is the ninth drop since then. And this work was so impressive that it won the Ig Nobel Prize last year. Okay. So another implication of scale is the fact that if you look at the fastest motor time scale, the fastest motion that has been detected on molecular motors, it's about 10 to the minus 3 seconds. Now if you look at, just calculate very easily, if you take 20 kBT and you estimate the time for this energy to dissipate away on a scale of tens of nanometers, you find that it dissipates away on the time scales, which are 10 to the minus 7 seconds. And that has a very, very neat implication for people modeling it. It means that it's pretty safe to assume that these are in local thermal equilibrium. Temperature plays a role in the transition between the different states, and you can just use, if you want, a local version of decay balance, and I'll do this explicitly in a few slides. Okay. So the scale of nanometers implies a few things. Just to summarize, first of all, we have no inertia, so we have basically diffusive behavior, which is very different, for example, from the behavior, because you have no inertia, it's very different from cars, I think, right? And then you can also assume local thermal equilibrium, and basically what I mean is that the transition rates obey a local version of detail balance. And I'll get to this explicitly in a few slides. So people have been studying this not only theoretically, but also have been doing experiments on these things. And the most prominent one, the most useful that has come up in probably about 10, 15 years, are single molecule experiments. And the idea is that we want to study the behavior of a single motor, not a whole bunch of motors. We're not looking at an ensemble of motors, under some an influence of some external perturbation, a force. So the idea is very similar. So suppose you want to understand how a car works, then you could open the engine, but that's really hard for something that small. So what you could do is start loading the car with more and more junk in the trunk and ask, how does the velocity of the car, how does the car respond to the junk that I'm throwing in the trunk? Okay? So the way that you do this, you're just applying some external perturbation, which happens to be force. You take, for example, a Keynesian motor, and you connect a polystyrene bead to it. And like Patricia was, I don't remember who was saying this, somebody mentioned that the scale on these figures is completely off scale. The size of the motor is about 17 nanometers. The size of these beads are typically half a micron. And even vesicles are many times half a micron. So it's lugging this huge thing on its back typically. Okay. So you connect a bead by some biological glue. I won't get into this now. And then you apply an optical trap, which basically exerts a force on the bead. Okay. It's very simple physics. It creates a dipole and the bead, which then interacts again with the electromagnetic field itself. And then you can make sure that this trap, and I'll show you in a second how this is done, this trap is exerting some force on the Keynesian itself, and from this you can deduce many characteristics about the motor, and I'll show you in a second how you do that. So the way, I think Patricia showed you this movie, and this will be my last movie if you've grown impatient with movies. This is what they actually see in a typical experiment. You can see I don't know if you can see it, you can very loosely see in this case the microtubule, and you can track the bead, and you can actually take its location as a function of time and just track its behavior. Okay. And a lot of the experiments I'll show are actually done, I should say this, there's a couple of central labs, and much of the data I'll be showing comes from the Block lab at Stanford. So the tweezers exert a force, and typically the force is exerted in the direction which opposes the motion.
So does the thing stop completely?
We'll get to that in a second. Okay? And this is a typical outcome of an experiment. This is the location of the bead as a function of time. And what you see in red, it's typically shown in many of the results of such experiments, is the location of the trap as a function of time. And to make sure that it's exerting a constant force on the bead, what you have to make sure is that the distance between the bead and the center of the trap is more or less constant. For first approximation, the bead is exerting some harmonic potential on the bead. And this is done by a feedback mechanism, which makes sure that this is true, and you can see a trace of a single kinesin moving. And there's much information you can read off this. For example, you can read off that the steps that it's taking are 8 nanometers. Okay? And that's the size of a dimer on the microtubule, so it all makes sense. You can do something smarter, which was done by the Block lab. Somewhat debatable result, but I think it's kind of a neat idea. You can look at the statistics of the different the length of each of these pauses, and you find that there are two groups, which each of them are roughly distributed in the Poisson manner with a different time constant, and that suggests that it's moving along hand over hand in a non-symmetric way. Okay, so the consensus that's been seen explicitly in experiments also is that it's moving hand over hand along the track. Okay. So what you do is actually repeat this experiment many times for each force and do it for different forces. And then you extract something which I'll discuss a lot in these talks, which is called the velocity force curve. Even though it's typically plotted the velocity as a function of force, many times it's called the force velocity curve. Okay, but for this crowd it won't confuse you. So this is a typical outcome. You can see two curves which have been taken experimentally. One in blue corresponds to one concentration of ATP, a high concentration of ATP, and one in red, which is a low concentration of ATP. And you can see that, of course, as you apply, this is again counter to what you will have in a typical physics notation, as you increase the force opposing the direction, you get positive forces. Okay, but that doesn't matter. But as you increase the force, the velocity goes down, and you can see that the velocity is much higher if you have higher concentration of ATPs. Okay, so different, as you would guess, different chemical potential gradients yield different energy. And there's some force where the thing stalls. And you can read off the stall force, and it's roughly, you could say that this is the force that the motor can exert. And at this force, which is roughly around 6 piconewtons, 6 piconewtons per kinesin, the thing stalls completely. Okay? So the stall force is, so again, this is basically the force exerted by the motor. So to summarize what I've told you about kinesin is about 70 to 80 nanometers. Again, people torment it a bit. They would chop off, do mutations and chop off its tail and look at the behavior then. It uses ATP to move along the track. It moves along microtubules, which have a monomer size of 8 nanometers. They have a processivity, and I'll come to this term again and again. Processivity means, how many steps do you take before you fall off the track? These things eventually detach from the track on which they're moving. Okay? And it has a processivity of about 1 micron. It can take 100 steps before it falls off the track. Okay? So it's a rather processive, it's called a rather processive motor. You have motors which take 1 or 2 step and then they detach from the track. And finally, they exert forces of about 6 to 7 piconewtons. And as I've told you, they have one end which binds to a cargo. One point that people don't realize many times is this is tailored in a very interesting way. In its generic state, it's made in such a way that if it's not bound to a cargo, then the tail binds to those legs with which it's walking along the microtubule, and then it can't attach to the microtubule. So if there's no cargo, it can't attach to the microtubule. If there is a cargo, it can attach to the microtubule. Now there's some variants, sometimes people get rid of this feature by making the tail very short.
Yeah, just a question. I mean, if you exceed the force beyond this threshold value, does it start moving back or it just stalls?
Yeah, that was a huge debate in this community, and about a year ago it was shown, yes, it moves backwards. Okay. There was a we can discuss it later. There was a huge debate if it really moves backward, and it obviously does. Okay. So forces are about piconewtons, distances are about nanometer, and then we look, if you take KBT with T room temperature and you write it in the corresponding units, it's 4.1 piconewtons times nanometer, and that tells you immediately that you're playing in the scale, the forces and distances where thermal fluctuations are important. So thermal fluctuations play an important role when you model these motors. You can't throw them off outside the window. So the ingredients for modeling are, I'm just repeating what I've told you before, no inertia, so it will be some sort of biased random walker. It will be noisy because we have both the temperature and also the fuel itself is discrete, right? It's binding discrete fuel. It's not like your car, which is gulping a fluid fuel liquid. And it's safe to assume local thermal equilibrium. Okay, and this is something that you have to check again and again. For example, if you're doing unzipping other single molecule experiments, it's not obvious that it holds. So how do people, motors use chemical energy to function, and people have tried to model this for a long time, and loosely speaking there have been two approaches, one which has been talked about a bit here, and I'll go over the details again during this talk, which are Brownian ratchets, and the other is something more simple, which is called a power stroke. And what I'll do is discuss both power stroke and both Brownian ratchets, and I'll try to tell you what the difference is, and if there is a difference at all. Sometimes it's a big arguing point. Is it a power stroke or a Brownian ratchet? And again, in both of these models, we rely on the fact that the motor has some internal state. So the basic idea is that you have ATP plus the motor, okay? And then the motor uses the energy from the ATP, so the ATP breaks into ADP and the phosphate. Again, it's acting like an enzyme, basically, for this reaction. And at the end of the process, it's moved one step to the right. So the power stroke is pretty easy to understand. The basic idea is that there's some internal spring. And probably the easiest way to do this is make a small picture. If I can hold this. Okay. So the picture will be that the track is some asymmetric configuration. And the motor has some internal degree, which is modeled by a spring. So the idea in these kinds of models is that the ATP binds to the spring and gives its energy, so the spring compresses because of the ATP. And then the spring is released by some latch, some stochastic process, and the spring pushes it to the other side. Okay, so you can actually take the spring analogy and make it a bit more quantitative, but the basic outcome of these models is that you have a biased random walker. The spring is almost always pushed to one side, but once in a while it's pushed to another side. Okay, so again, I'm just repeating, the spring is compressed, then it's released, and there's some stochasticity there, and then the motor moves one step to the right, and once in a while it will move to the left. So the basic idea is that if you think of this as a power stroke, you just assume that it's a biased random walker. Okay? And you can complicate this picture by, instead of having like the spring, which loosely had one internal state, you could have many internal states. And modeling motors as biased random walkers has been done by many people, and most recently it was pushed a lot by Fisher and Kolomaisky and co-workers and the concept of kinesin. So this is one type of modeling. Again, basically, in some sense, this is saying, forget about what really causes it to move. Just assume that it's a biased random walker.
some mechanism causing it.
The second type of model is, again, the concept of Brownian ratchet is very old. I mean, it was mentioned during the talks here. What I'll do is describe one model which was introduced by Ulrich Herr and Paul. And the basic idea of these Brownian ratchets is that you rectify a Brownian motion. And here I've depicted a particularly simple setup. So again, an important ingredient is that the motor has two internal states. Okay? So the motor can be either in a state where it's feeling the potential, so this is along the track, and the motor can be in one state in which it's feeling the potential U of X, which is a sawtooth potential, and in another state where it's feeling a flat potential. Okay, so we have two types of potential, and of course for the thing to move, you have to have transitions between the different types of states. Okay? So the idea is that it can make these transitions via two mechanisms. The first mechanism is just by thermal fluctuations. You're in state U, you use the thermal fluctuations, and you shoot up to state W. Okay? The other method is, of course, use chemical energy. Okay, so we're using the chemical energy, and when we're using the chemical energy, we shoot ourselves from state U into state W. So to capture what I've told you in word, what people do is say that the transition rate between state U and state W, which I've denoted by R1, is just some term which is proportional to the exponential of the potential chemical energy difference over temperature, plus some term which is solely due to thermal fluctuations. So we have two contributions, and of course, as I've told you, I'll assume local detail balance, then I have a factor which is proportional to the energy difference. And then coming back, going from state W into state U, of course, you just satisfy detail balance trivially, and you get just that it's a sum of these coefficients. Now, why did this thing work at all? Well, suppose that you have a motor or a Brownian walker which is sitting here. The potential will pull it down into this location, and then rate R1 will kick in, so it shoots up into this location. Once it's up here, it's feeling a flat potential, so it's basically diffusing. Okay, so it's diffusing upside here, and eventually rate R2 will kick in. And now if we look at this probability distribution, the part which will fall here will be dragged into this location here. Okay, so whatever dropped down from here will be dragged into this new minima. However, whatever dropped down from here will be dragged into the same minima where we were before. Okay, so I hope this is clear. So the idea is that for this to work, first of all, it's obvious that I have to have an asymmetric potential. If I had a symmetric potential, then the number of the fraction that would move to the right and the fraction that would move to the left would be completely equal. Another thing that I must have is a chemical potential difference. If I don't have a chemical potential difference, right, I can't expect the same thing to walk. And to see this is very easy if you have delta mu equal to zero, then you can see that this just satisfies detail balance. So of course the thing doesn't move. Another thing which people stress less when they discuss these motors is that these rates must depend on location. If these rates don't depend on location, then of course this is just a constant, this is another constant, and I could just redefine this as an effective detail balance. So if you want to make this thing work, you have to have an asymmetric potential, you have to have a chemical energy gradient, and you have to have these rates specifically dependent on location. If they're not depending on location, they won't walk whatsoever. Okay? And this is typically done by taking very localized transition rates near the minima here. Okay, so again, two channels for transitions, chemical and thermal, and once we have all these conditions, you can show that it moves. Is this clear? People look a bit tired.
I don't understand what the the W state is. Suddenly, it doesn't feel the potential anymore when it's in that state.
Right. It's just a toy model. So loosely speaking, there's two states of the motor in this model. One is which it's feeling the structure of the track, and one is which it's loosely connected to the track, so it's feeling less. And I'll come to this in the next slide.
What is the difference between the two mechanisms? I didn't really understand. They both have two, they have internal.
Right. So one of my points is that there's not a big difference, but it's debated as a big difference. I don't think there's a difference, but this will come up in four slides. Okay. So how do you analyze these models? Well, you write down Fokker-Planck equations for each of the two states. It's just a simple exercise. And what you do is you just look at the joint probability of being at position W and U, and it's easy to get from that the condition under which it moves. And I won't go through the derivation because in a few slides I'll introduce a much simpler model in which you can get all these features in a two-line calculation. Okay, so the condition for it to move is an asymmetric potential, no detailed balance, and what you find out is that, like David was hinting, that if you look at long length scales and long times, it's basically diffusion with drift. And now to Martin's question, of course the ratchet that I've drawn before is typically shown is a really, it's the worst way you could design a ratchet. Because when you go up, it's diffusing freely. And of course, if you want to move to the right, this is a very unsensible thing to do. And to get a more effective ratchet, what you have to do is have two shifted sawtooth potentials. Okay? And then you can see that when you climb up, you're basically pushed here. There's no diffuse, you're not losing as many parts. Okay? It's a very obvious statement. Okay. So what I'll do now in the last part is so one of the questions was, what's the big difference between these things? And part of the reason which people think that there's a big difference is that it's kind of, one is set up in this one is very simple, it's just a biased random walker, and one is set up in this context of coupled Fokker-Planck equations, which are actually typically very hard to solve analytically. You have to do them numerically. But the argument, loosely speaking, is that here you have a nice actual microscopic mechanism for generating motion, and in the other you're kind of hiding it. So what I'll do now is introduce a very simple model that we've introduced together with David Lubensky and David Nelson, in which it's a very simple lattice version of these models, which is simple enough that you can understand everything very, very quickly, and it's simple enough that I'll be able to solve it. It's really very short to solve it exactly. Okay. So the idea is again that you have a motor which is using ATP to move along a track, and the way to think about this lattice version is that the motor can be in two states, one in which it has two legs on one side of the monomer, and one in which it has one leg on two sides of the monomer. So this is loosely, you could, of course, have other interpretations. And it's a lattice model, and what I'll do is I'll denote hopping rates on the lattice. So my notation is kind of funny. The hopping rate from state A to state B is WA with a right arrow. The hopping rate from site B into site A, going down in this direction, is WB to the right. And similarly, from B to A is WB to the left, and from A to B is WA to the left. So the motor is moving like this, and we want to model it in a spirit which is similar to what we have in the previous models. So remember, we have two channels for transitions. One is thermal, and one is chemical energy. So that's easy to implement. If we're hopping from site A into site B, then we have a thermal transition, and we have a transition which is mediated by the chemical energy. I'm just reminding you, this is exactly what we had here, but just on the lattice version. Okay? And then I'm allowing for just for generality to have an energy difference between these two sites. Okay, and here I'm ignoring the external force that might work on this. Now, if we want to satisfy this local version of DTL balance, then it's easy. The hopping rate back is just the sum of these two constants. Now, the transition between these two sites is just equivalent, but now we allow different coefficients, alpha prime and omega prime. This is sort of analogy to the fact that you had to have the coefficients depend on location in the previous model. Okay? So the transition rates are going up either thermal or chemical energy, going down just satisfying local DTL balance. And it's a trivial exercise to analyze this model. It's just one line. Okay? So what you do is you ask, what kind of energy landscape, and this is a concept that I'll be using again and again, what kind of energy landscape would describe the dynamics of this inherently non-equilibrium system? So of course it's a tilted energy landscape. Okay, so just by analogy, we had a biased random walker, it's described by a random walker moving along a tilted potential. Okay? So you ask, what kind of energy landscape describes this kind of dynamics? And I'll decimate over these two sites, and of course it comes out to be that the effective energy difference is given by the temperature times log of the hopping rates to the left over hopping rates to the right. Nothing too surprising. Okay. And I'll show you that if you do this very almost trivial exercise, you get all the conditions that we have had before, but just for free. So the effective energy difference is just T times the log of the ratio of the hopping rate to the right over the hopping rate to the left. And you can see that we have this coefficients alpha plus omega times alpha prime chemical transition, thermal transition. And you can see, you can read out the results immediately. If you don't have a chemical potential difference, okay, then this delta mu is zero. This term cancels with this term. This term cancels with this term. You have log of 1. No motion whatsoever. So no chemical energy, no motion, no surprise. What about a symmetric potential? If we had a symmetric potential, it basically means that alpha is equal to alpha prime, omega is equal to omega prime, and then you can see that this term will cancel this term, this term will cancel this term, and then you have no motion whatsoever. So in a sense, it's a very complicated way of saying that if you don't have a bias to the right, it doesn't move to the right. Okay? Okay. So what this means is if you look at the effective energy difference between two sites which are n monomers apart, then you just glue in this effective energy difference and you get some tilt and you get bias diffusion. Okay, and again, this is so simple that you can get all these results which are pretty hard in the context of the ratchet models, you could just get them in a few lines. Okay, so back to ratchet. I've shown you basically two approaches. One is power stroke, one is ratchet, and one is a mixture of them too. There's been some debate, and some people say, "Oh no, Kayaganesian is not a ratchet; it's described by a power stroke model." And some people will be very strong on the opposite direction. And as David was suggesting before, there's no huge difference between the two approaches. Okay, they're basically the same thing. This is a personal opinion. The ratchet is a bit more generic, and it's obvious that it could be made to behave as a power stroke. Okay. Yeah.
Can you calculate the force velocity curve in this model?
Yeah, it's easy. Straightforward. Okay, so a short summary of what I've told you so far. So molecular motors are complexes of proteins which use chemical energy to perform mechanical work. I've shown you that they're actually studied by single molecule experiment, and these provide data on traces of motors which give information on the motors. You can read off their stall force, their velocity, their step size, and many other things. And the models, which basically ingredient is having internal states, provided just justification, if you want, for treating the motors as a biased random walker, which you might as well have done from point zero. Okay. So any questions up to this point? Okay. So far what I've done is described monads which move on a periodic substrate. Okay? Now this is not always the case. For example, in this whole process that I've described before, you have, I remind you, RNA polymerase running along the DNA, reading parts of the DNA, producing RNA, and when the motor is running along the DNA, it's actually moving along a substrate which has different content as you move along the DNA. As it's moving along the DNA, it's feeling different bases, it's reading the information there. Okay? So inherently, it's moving along a disordered track. When you have a ribosome moving along the messenger RNA, again, it's moving along a disordered track because it's moving along the RNA, and the RNA is composed out of a specific sequence of nucleotides. Okay? So the motors involved in this process are motors that move along a disordered substrate. And what I'll do is focus on a motor that was rather well characterized experimentally, and this is, again, the RNA polymerase. And I'll give you a few facts on it. So the RNA polymerase moves along the DNA, and it's producing messenger RNA. Okay? The energy is actually the energy that provides its motion, is actually from the different nucleotides that make up this messenger RNA. So each bit that connects to this polymer that is being made is used as a source of energy to move this motor along the DNA. Okay? It has a very high processivity. Again, I remind you, processivity is how much can this motor move before it falls off the track. And this motor has to read thousands of base pairs sometimes, so it has a very, very high processivity. It hardly ever falls off the track. If you ask what's its stall force, well, they've been quoted to be larger or equal than 14 piconewtons, and in a second you'll see why it's such a vague statement, why it's not like kinesin and about 6 piconewtons. And the step size of this motor is the distance between base pairs along the DNA, which is known to be 0.34 nanometers, and that's been assumed and been shown explicitly in recent experiments. So how do you study this this motor? Well, you do a very similar experiment. You connect the bead to the RNA polymerase, and you pull on the polymerase. Now, I'll tell you one thing that people typically don't tell you. I'm kind of shooting myself in the leg, but it's an important point. When you look at the kinesin experiments, they have a very hard time. Sorry. Anyway, they have a very hard time knowing in which direction they're pulling the bead. So it's not at all obvious in these experiments that they're pulling it really back parallel to the track. This is one caveat that you have to keep in mind. It's just technically hard to know where you're pulling in these experiments. So many times you have to look at the data with some suspicion. Okay. Now with RNA polymerase, it's much better because you can actually connect two beads and pull on the RNA polymerase. You can pull on the RNA polymerase and align the two beads so you know exactly where you're pulling. So in some sense, these experiments are much more controlled than the kinesin experiment.
I didn't get it. Well, you put two beads?
You took two beads and you can align them one in front of the other. And you're pulling in this direction. You can know exactly where you're pulling. And automatically you know that you're pulling, you're not pulling the RNA polymerase off the track.
Okay? So you're saying one bead attached to the polymerase and one to the other end of the DNA. What are they?
Right, yeah, exactly.
So in that diagram string.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a typical example of such a trace. You can see that it's very different than kinesin. Kinesin, if you looked at it, so this is on a much coarse-grained scale, but kinesin, if you looked at it, it would move one step and more or less wait a Poissonian time, move to the other state, Poissonian time, move to the next step. If you look here, the RNA polymerase is moving but pausing for very long durations at specific points. It's actually pausing, if you read off, for about 20 seconds at specific locations along the DNA. If you look at the velocity force curve, and this is normalized, so roughly, it's not an extremely fast process, roughly the velocity, the peak velocity of RNA polymerase is 30 base pairs per second. You can see that the velocity goes down, and then you get this funny kind of convex shape near the stall force. Okay? And this is why people quote, well, about larger than 14 piconewtons, because it's actually hard to say where it's actually cutting the axis. So just to compare, so I'll end this talk probably by comparing again the kinesin and the RNA polymerase, and in the next talk I'll try and convince you that by knowing non-equilibrium statistical mechanics, that knowing non-equilibrium statistical mechanics might be important for interpreting these experiments. Okay? So you have to know some things about non-equilibrium to get the correct information out of these experiments. And this, comparing, this is the Kinesin curve. You can see that it more or less goes smoothly to zero. People actually fit this in great detail. Kinesin is moving along a periodic substrate. RNA polymerase has this funny curve compared to this one. It's bending near the stall force. It's moving along the disorder track, but typically the community which models these things ignore the fact that this is moving along a periodic track, this is moving along a disordered substrate, and what they do is say, oh, there's an off, I can give you the details over dinner, it's a very simple model. They say that there's an off-pathway state which is not influenced by force, and that leads to the fact that you have this velocity as a function of force curve, and what I'll argue that it's a more subtle effect, and you have to know something to interpret the data. But I think it's probably a good point for me to stop.